This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m., and we rebroadcast Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available on podcast on iTunes. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone and search for DC 37 State of the Union. We're on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about this show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. And tonight we welcome Duke University Professor of History and Public Policy Nancy McLean to talk about her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She joins by phone from Los Angeles, where I suspect the weather is a little better than it is here in New York. Good evening, Professor McLean.
Good evening. It's good, great to be with you, Chris.
Let me begin. I've been reading the book over the past few days, and I want to go to the blurb on the jacket. The question is, what is really happening to American politics? Behind the headlines of billionaires taking over our government is the surprising story of a secretive cause with deep and troubling roots. Democracy in Chains uncovers the history of the well-heeled radical right's vast network and explains why this movement doesn't want simply to change who rules, but to fundamentally alter the rules of democratic governance as we have known it in the United States. But while billionaires now drive the effort, they did not start it. Nancy McLean names the true author of this cause's playbook, economist James McGill Buchanan, and documents for the first time the strategy he and his collaborators developed over six decades to disempower the majority. So, Professor McLean, the question I have for you, who was James McGill Buchanan?
Well, I would start by saying that if you've never heard from him and your listeners have never heard of him, don't feel bad. I had never heard of him when I started the research that became this book. And I think there's a reason for that. There were figures who were part of this aggressively pro-market cause, like Milton Friedman, who loved to be out in the limelight and couldn't get enough media attention. James McGill Buchanan was someone who was much more content to work in the shadows and work for a long-term vision of transformation. So he was born in Tennessee, did most of his work over his career, ironically, in Virginia public universities. He was the only U.S. Southern-born economist to win the Nobel Prize in economic sciences, which he did in 1986. And what he contributed to the right libertarian cause was something that no one else did, and that was an understanding of how the government had grown over the course of the 20th century, particularly through citizen organizing and pressure and workers organizing. And with that, then, in the last several decades of his life, he began to work on a strategy to undermine that collective power and to push government back to, it sounds preposterous, but to a version of government more like what we saw in 1900. And that's a version of government that would not be popular with the citizenry in any way, a government without Social Security or Medicare or workers' rights or, you know, regulation to protect our air and water, all the rest of it. None of that would be popular. And so he thought about other ways to make that happen. And because we have allowed inequality to grow to such an extent in our society, we have multi-billionaires like Charles Koch who found a way forward in those ideas and have invested heavily in organizations that will carry forth that agenda to effectively enchain our democracy.
So these, so the billionaires, the Koch brothers of the world, embrace Buchanan's ideas over a period of time. You know, we talk a lot on this show and at the union about the connections between, mm-hmm. you know, things don't happen in vacuums. Things don't happen.
Right.
There is a context for this. So he was, by dint of his academic background or by dint of his publications, he gets on the screen of these other folks who have their own view of the world, and it seems to mesh with Buchanan's, or he's shaping their view of the world. How does this work?
Yeah, interesting question. I think there's a kind of reciprocity there, you know, ideas and influence going back and forth. But he actually set to work in Charlottesville, Virginia, of all places, lately much in the news, in 1956, yes, as the state of Virginia was fighting, was leading the wider South in the fight against Brown versus Board of Education. And he was allowed to set up a new center for what he called for the study of political economy and social philosophy. And in that center, he developed these ideas. He took what was basically some very, I don't know, sort of gut level right wing ideas about the world, you know, that voters were voting themselves a living, and that politicians, you know, were selling themselves with other people's taxes to voters. He took a lot of those ideas and turned them into what he called this science of public choice economics. And so from the very beginning, though, he had the investment of the major funder of right-wing free market ideas, the same funder that supported Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, Milton Friedman, the Mont-Pelerin Society.
Who is that?
Listeners. It was called the William Volcker Fund, and interestingly, it was the parent of an organization that has been close to Charles Koch's heart ever since the late 1960s, when the William Volcker Fund collapsed. Koch set up something else called the Institute for Humane Studies, and has served on its board and even been the president of it at one point. But it was an organization designed to support this kind of thought that could help enable the breakthrough to the libertarian world that they knew most people didn't want. So James Buchanan, from the very beginning in 1956, had five-year startup funding from this organization. And as the years went on, he was connected with virtually every other group that you could imagine that's part of this, you know, kind of radical free market right, including the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Mont-Pelerin Society, all these different groups had him in their orbit. But again, they were all working toward the same goals, but Buchanan was really the only one who provided ideas that could be turned into an operational strategy to undermine popular power. And particularly over the years, he took aim at public sector workers and unions. And of course, we see this coming with the Janus case that the Supreme Court will be hearing in February. But this is the product of a long considered, you know, hostility and attempt to attack and undermine public sector workers' power, to the point that Buchanan said on more than one occasion that public sector workers should not be allowed to vote.
To vote in elections?
Yes. Exactly. Not only not be allowed. I mean, he said it, you know, offhandedly. It wasn't like he built a big theory around that, but that gives you a sense of where this was coming from, that he was so opposed to the notion that public sector workers would be able to affect their conditions of work collectively through the political process.
God forbid that should happen.
Exactly.
God forbid.
He never called for, you know, disenfranchising companies who had lobbies or, you know, any of that. But this really singular attack on workers' power, and particularly public sector workers, because his own specialty, I should mention, was in public finance. Hmm. So looking at taxation and government spending, and as a white man of the mid-century South, he was very much opposed to all the changes that came with the New Deal and the Civil Rights Movement, and believed that government was expanding as a result of them in a way that he did not approve of and did not think was beneficial for the economy.
We're talking with Duke University professor Nancy McLean, discussing her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean will be at the Union on February 8th. And if you want more information about that, 212-815-1700, discussing her book. She is our guest for this evening's segment. I've got a question about 1981. I believe it's 1981. PATCO. And the, you know, in the labor movement, we sort of track, this is the beginning of the attack on American labor, Ronald Reagan firing the PATCO traffic controllers. And what I hear you saying is that long before 1981, there was a philosophy that, you know, the philosophy and the incident and the incident and the there's a merger. There is an opportunity. Ronald Reagan could have handled that in any number of ways, and this is the way he chose to handle it. Is it influenced by these think tanks and by these academics?
Yeah, Ronald Reagan was definitely part of this milieu for a long time. I mean, going back certainly at least to his support for Barry Goldwater in 1964, who we don't think about in these terms now, but Barry Goldwater, at least in his domestic agenda, was the first, you could say, the first neoliberal candidate or free market fundamentalist. I mean, he opposed union power. He despised Walter Reuther of the UAW, calling him the most dangerous man in America. He wanted to see flat taxes instead of progressive income taxes. He wanted to privatize Social Security. You know, you could just go on and on. And Goldwater, interestingly, was defeated everywhere in the country except the places that practiced the most extreme voter suppression. So that was also a lesson, I think, for this cause. But those ideas are part of the right-wing milieu that Reagan, that helped elect Reagan, you know, in the, you know, then there's the wider right of the National Review and the Heritage Foundation and so forth. So yes, Ronald Reagan was steeped in some of these ideas, and some of Buchanan's students went into the Reagan administration in prominent positions, including one figure as head of the Office of Management and Budget after David Stockman left. So Reagan, yeah, very much has these ideas. But again, much of the thinking that went into that project was done in the 1970s. And also in the more recent period, what we've seen is a kind of radicalization of existing right-to-work laws so that they've gone much farther than they used to. And that, again, is Buchanan's influence. So case in point, Scott Walker, didn't just, push for right to work, but actually specified in great detail that unions should not be allowed to bargain for almost anything, right? They must get renewed annually. They must, you know, just many, many, many different measures, rules changes that in combination have devastated public sector unionism in Wisconsin. And that is not coincidental because Scott Walker was very much operating out of a playbook that was James Buchanan's ideas weaponized.
And this has been going, and we're saying that this goes back 60 years. We are now, what we are dealing with in 2018 is a movement.
Goes way back. I will say the exact ideas were not worked out in the beginning, you know, so it's not as if they put everything in a time capsule and just waited for the right moment. What we're seeing is also the product of growing frustration among the radical right and the radical right rich, people like Charles Koch, because what they saw again and again is that the people didn't want these ideas, right? When people learned that Barry Goldwater supported the privatization of Social Security in 1964, they fled from him, right?
Right.
And so arguing for these ideas openly and saying what they actually wanted repelled people. And that was the experience again and again. So even Ronald Reagan talked the talk of this movement and was an inspiration to them in the way he framed the issues. But even in his first budget, when he realized that what the libertarians wanted from him would have devastated Social Security, would have just undermined Medicare, would have hurt farmers, veterans, workers, teachers, state and local government. There's actually a whole list that Stockman talks about. When Reagan realized that, he said, well, I don't want to do that. That would make me unpopular.
Right, right.
So he backs up from the brink and instead gives us huge deficits. So that was a source of huge frustration to these folks on the right. Similarly, George W. Bush was a terrible disappointment. He gave the seniors the prescription drug benefit and did many other things. So the plan that we're seeing unfold right now, this very integrated, sophisticated, calculated strategy, is actually the result of people who are deeply frustrated. And time and again, any elected official who has been accountable to the voters has backed up from putting through their agenda because they know they'll be destroyed at the polls. So what the Koch donor network has done, weaponizing Buchanan's thought, is to come up with this kind of multi-layered stealth plan to achieve what they want to. And that begins with destroying unions without saying that's what you're actually going to do. You know, no, Scott Walker never campaigned on that, but that's the, as he put it, when he said we dropped the bomb, that's what he was trying to do, to destroy labor for a whole series of reasons that I'm sure your folks well know. But then also they have done the most radical gerrymandering to misrepresent the will of voters in the states they control, and that's some 30 states now where they have an electoral hammerlock. They have pushed through massive voter suppression. They have operated without the usual procedures, both in the, you know, in the Senate and in the states. They have done a great deal of their, pushed through a great deal of their agenda with secrecy. So this is really a radical, highly strategic, well-calculated plan that is, again, operating as it's operating because they understand that they cannot tell the voters honestly what the world they're seeking is because people won't go for it.
I am in the book, there is a chapter begins with Buchanan's response to his experience at UCLA in the 1960s, and in particular, the reaction by the academic community to his firing of Angela Davis. Mm-hmm. Now, as a young man in New York City, the writings of Angela Davis, Eldridge Cleaver, Huey Newton were you were able to discuss these things in classrooms in the 1960s and 70s as points of view. And these are legitimate, I don't want to say revolutionaries, mm-hmm. but in certain circles, these folks were anathema and a threat to the future of the United States. And I'm just wondering what role race plays in this, in the Buchanan Koch view of the world.
Yeah, it's huge. And actually, in the story that you tell about Angela Davis at being at UCLA when Buchanan was there, she was the most popular professor on campus, right?
Right, right.
People were flocking to hear from her. So there again, we have that issue of the popular visions and ideas versus this hard right libertarianism. And for the cause that I have written about, I would say that's another one of the distinctive aspects of the book, is that I found the trail of this story in the South in the 1950s in the reaction from this hard right to Brown versus Board of Education. And I was able to show how Buchanan and others in this libertarian milieu exploited the white supremacist reaction to Brown versus Board of Education to move a libertarian agenda of school privatization. And so I don't think that race was, you know, the uppermost motive in his mind or in that of the other, you know, hyper free market people who flocked to the support of these white Southern governments who were underwriting private schools so that racist parents could escape Brown. I don't think that was uppermost, but I don't think you could ever imagine doing that if you weren't racist, right?
Right.
And also, I think it's almost worse than people who, you know, in an ethical sense, to me, it's worse than people who were kind of blinded by an irrational racism, because here what we see is a highly calculated decision to exploit white supremacy to move this agenda. And I think that's important to point out because that's exactly what we're seeing now in Donald Trump's America, that there are people who are in the Republican base who, you know, will believe anything, right, about people of color who are deeply racist. But then you also have Donald Trump consciously exploiting that and the people in the groups around them pushing this kind of strategic racism to make sure that white voters in their base will go to the polls to keep them in power while Donald Trump pushes through the Koch agenda. And Charles Koch himself has caviled about having gotten through more in the last year than they had been able to get through in the previous decade and getting more through in the last 5 years than he had been able to get through in the last 50.
I have a friend I have a friend on Facebook who every time Trump tweets and everybody goes crazy over some outrageous Trump tweet, he keeps saying, distraction, distraction.
I love it. Yeah, I have said that too. I'm doing a lot of speaking for the book around the country, and people love it when I say that, but it's just like, you know, let's take a time out Trump, right? Just
right.
Like, you start a campaign and ignore that man, because that is exactly it. He is a master of distraction, and we fall right into the trap, and we focus on him, and we get so agitated that we can't think. And meanwhile, an agency after, right? I mean,
right.
The Department of Labor, the Department of Justice, the Environmental Protection Agency, Federal Anti-Discrimination Enforcement, in domain after domain, they are rushing through the most radical changes that we have seen in our lifetime while we're focused on this man's tweet. So tell your friend, give your friend a shout out and say, I'm totally with him. And that's what we should just say, distraction, distraction, and pivot our attention toward what he's trying to distract us from.
So, and let's talk about this a little bit, because, you know, Donald Trump is a New Yorker. I've known Donald, mm-hmm. I mean, I used to be a tabloid newspaper reporter. So I, you know, there's a whole nother Donald Trump who I know, and he was basically a non-ideological fellow who has chosen, I believe, to, you know, ride this horse for his own purposes. But the real ideology behind all this, you said something earlier that, you know, voter suppression is a key part of this. You cannot get this stuff done unless you are suppressing people's voices. Is that
absolutely
your take?
Absolutely. And Buchanan himself was explicit about this. I realize there were a few quotes that fell out in the last cuts of the hardback edition. We're going to a paperback edition this summer, and they'll go back in. But one thing that Buchanan said, this is in 2001, after Charles Koch started weaponizing Buchanan's ideas. Buchanan wrote some notes, and he said, Adam Smith, after all, was you know, putting forward his ideas, and this is a quote from Buchanan, in a world in which the demos had not yet been fully unchained.
Jeez.
The demos being the people, right? And this
right.
world of slavery had not yet been fully enchained. And he said governments then, with elite control and a restricted franchise, governments might have listened to reason, meaning the kind of ideas, you know, that they want for the market and for government. But he said with the spread of voting rights, you know, and in this new world, it was impossible to get the electorate to support their agenda. So it's actually that explicit. And I think this is the single most important finding in my book, is to have them saying again and again in their own words that they know the majority is not with them, and so they have to in effect go around the back of the majority. Here's another one. Charles Koch said in 1997, when they started really laying down the foundations for what we've seen in the last few years in a big way, so it was before Obama. Obama was just a helpful coincidence, like Patco, as you mentioned before. But when Koch was laying all this groundwork in 1997, he said, and this is a direct quote, "Since we are greatly outnumbered, the failure to use our superior technology ensures failure."
So
that's like, wow, you know, like he knows people don't want it. And the only way you can get it through is with what he calls that technology. And that technology is Buchanan's ideas weaponized and then put into the organizing projects of what is now literally hundreds of organizations, right? There's dozens at the national level that are ostensibly separate and working together, including the Federalist Society, Changing the Courts. Koch put seed money into that. There's also all the state affiliates of the State Policy Network that have been, you know, making life hell for public sector workers and for public education and for all kinds of other public goods at the state level. And then they also have an international group called the Atlas Network, which has 450 affiliates in 90 countries. So this is such a highly calculated and strategic effort. And by the way, what they're building towards is a constitutional convention called by the states under Article 5 of the Constitution to change the U.S. Constitution to enshrine this libertarian agenda so that people cannot organize or affect government as we have over the course of the 20th century. So it is incredibly audacious, incredibly radical, and would only be going through because there is so much money concentrated now among these arch-right billionaires who are funding these things.
We just, here in New York, we just got through fighting a state constitutional convention, which had some backing by the Mercer folks who are part of this right-wing billionaire network. This idea of a national constitutional convention, you have any sense of how that works or what the form is for that?
Well, here's the interesting thing. It is so radical that it's never been tried before in the United States, okay? So the Constitution provides, there's two methods in the Constitution that can allow for amendment, and one is the one we've seen over and over again, which has brought, you know, lots of mostly good amendments, like the, you know, 14th and 15th Amendment and, you know, women's right to vote, youth voting, et cetera, et cetera. but the right has been defeated at that root over and over again. And so what they have gone to is building at the state levels. And that's part of the reason why they put so much effort into state politics, first of all, because it's cheap and efficient. It's easier to control them than the federal government. And by the time you get enough of them, you can transform the federal government. So they have at this point lined up 28 of the 34 states needed to call such a convention. And here's the kicker. There are six more states that are where both houses of the legislature are controlled by Republicans that have not yet authorized. And I believe, and I did an op-ed about this for The Hill, that they will use the $1.5 trillion deficit the recent tax bill is estimated to be creating. They will use that deficit to get those remaining authorizations for a constitutional convention. Because the loss leader, the first thing they put out to get authorization for this convention is a balanced budget amendment, which polls well until people realize that it means the end of Social Security and Medicare and the environmental regulations and all the other things that they care about. But the thing about a state constitutional convention is, by definition, it's a runaway convention, because once they get in the door, they can consider anything. And the right wing, this Koch-backed right, would come in with 10 what they call liberty amendments already planned, of which the balanced budget amendment is just one. National voter ID law is another. They actually also want to roll back the 17th Amendment from the progressive era that let people directly elect their senators instead of having them chosen by corporate-dominated state governments. So, I mean, this is, again, it is so audacious, and it is so radical, and that's why I'm trying to alert as many people as possible to this, because I do believe that it can be stopped. And, in fact, on this constitutional convention, Common Cause, you know, the civic group Common Cause has been playing a very leading role, and they've gotten four states to rescind their authorizations. Now, the problem...
So that's a good sign.
That's a really good sign.
We're running out of time.
Okay.
So I just wanted to... I hate cutting people off, especially you, because this has been a terrific conversation. But there's more of you at DC 37 on February 8th. Professor Nancy McLean discussing her book, Democracy in Chains. And for more information on how to attend her visit on February 8th, please call 212-815-1700. I'm sorry we're out of time, but it has been a total education talking to you this evening.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to meeting you later this week.
All right, terrific.
Whatever it is, next week. I've lost track of time.
It's February 8th, Thursday, February 8th at 6 p.m. All right, we are out of time. I just want to remind folks that we are doing February 24th is going to be a day of action, Workers' Day of Action at Foley Square. We'll be hopefully thousands strong in the spirit of Martin Luther King, and we hope that you can be there. For more information, please call the Political Action Department at 212-815-1550. That's Saturday, February 24th at 11 a.m. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. Rudy Orozco is our producer. I'm Chris Policano. Till next time, ciao.